Bagging is just one of the personality disorder traits, but a classic one, which explains why I didn't see it before. Narcissists are hard to spot, as they're often skilled at hiding their disorder from the world. "What's CSS?" I say, slipping my palms into my back jeans pockets. It's a casual move, but also a deliberate one. My phone is there, cold and hard and comforting against my fingers. I flip the ringer switch to silent. With any luck, he won't know it's there.
"Crunch security systems. The shares AppSec acquired in a venture capital payout back in 2013. I'm the one who told Will to move the shares to a company I set up in the Bahamas, and exactly when to liquidate them. He could have never come up with it on his own. He may be a whiz with computers, but he's hopeless when it comes to business."
I give Corbin an impressed brow lift, even though I'm only half listening. I need to keep him talking, to put as many words between us as possible. "But Will must have messed up somehow, because AppSec found out. I talked to Will's boss. He told me they had a forensic accountant tracing the money, and all signs point to Will." My cell phone vibrates against my hip with an incoming call. Can I swipe to pick up without him noticing? Corbin lifts a shoulder, a yeah-so gesture.
"We knew they'd find out eventually."
His indifference stumps me, enough so that my fingers freeze on my phone. I stand there for a moment, studying Corbin's nonplussed expression and pursed lips, remembering the two new life insurance policies and Will's list of household chores that last morning in bed. And the answer falls into place. I shake my head, unnerved I didn't think of it sooner. "You were going to disappear, weren't you? Both of you, I mean. You and Will were already planning to leave. So when the plane went down at the exact same time the money went missing, you assumed he took off with all of it." My phone falls still, flipping the collar to voicemail, then starts right up again.
"He did take off with all of it. You told me that."
I frown, trying to remember ever saying anything near those words. "I did?" Corbin nods.
"When you told me about the note in your drawer, remember? The one Will put there?"
My heart rate spikes at what he's implying, but before I can process his words, Corbin takes two steps closer. I back up, but there's nowhere for me to go. I'm already pressed against the counter.
"But he made one fatal mistake."
"What's that?" My voice cracks, and I hate myself for sounding so scared. He grins, werewolf teeth against skin black as coal.
"He left his pretty wife here, all alone."
My skin prickles, and I swallow down a spiky ball of nausea.
"You know, I can see what Will sees in you. Beyond the obvious, I mean. You're smart and you're funny, and you've got this thing about you."
Corbin waves a hand in my direction, his gaze dipping lower, then lower still.
"Delicate. Sexy. Will is a lucky, lucky man."
"Was," I say, correcting him. My mind is dull with fear and shock, and I can't think straight. The word comes out slow and sticky. He crosses his arms, studying me with narrowed eyes.
"You know, for a while there, I was convinced you were in on his vanishing act. But then you didn't break character. Not even when you thought my texts were from him. Either you really didn't know, or you and Will have been one step ahead of me this whole time."
"I'm not lying. I really didn't know."
"Yeah, I'm starting to believe."
He pushes away from the counter, stepping closer, then closer still, until the smell of his cologne churns my stomach.
"Let's smoke that rat out of his hole. What do you say?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, he won't answer me."
Corbin digs around in his pocket for his phone.
"But let's see if he'll respond to you."
Before I can say a word, he swings an arm around my neck, pulls my temple flush to his, and snaps a selfie. The flash is blinding, and I'm too shocked to do anything other than stare. While I blink away the white spots in my vision, Corbin hunches over his phone, his thumbs typing away. He attaches a picture to an email. No subject line, no message, just a picture of a smiling Corbin and a pale and wide-eyed me, and hits send. Almost immediately, a text pings his phone.
"Good news," he says, flipping the phone around so I can see. "Your husband is alive and well."
"Hurt her, and I'll slit your throat." Despite everything, despite my terror that's sharp and pointed, despite this madman who knows his way around an alarm and who I believe when he says he'll kill me, my euphoria is swift and unmistakable. Will is alive. My phone buzzes, and this time I snatch it from my pocket. Corbin doesn't stop me, just leans a hip against the counter and watches, that same creepy smile playing on his lips. The number is a long string of digits that look like they're coming from a foreign country. I swipe my thumb across the screen and press it to my ear, my voice barely audible above my thudding heart. "Hello?"
"Iris, get out of there."
My sob is thick and immediate. For the past 2 weeks, I've dreamed of this voice. I've prayed to a god I'm not entirely sure I believe in, bargained with everything dear for just one more chance of hearing it again. And now, here it is, finally. Finally, coming down the phone line, and all I can do is cry. "Will?"
"Did you hear any of what I just said? Corbin is dangerous. He will hurt you, or worse, in order to get to me. I'm on my way, but in the meantime, get out of there. I don't care what you have to do, just get away and go get help. Can you do that for me?"
Will is on his way. I know there were a lot of other words in there, but "I'm on my way" are the only ones I hear. My husband is on his way home. "Hurry!" Corbin snatches the phone from my ear.
"Yeah, buddy. You better hurry. Your pretty little wife is waiting. Oh, and don't forget my money. This little stunt you just pulled will cost you your share of the funds."
I lunge at my phone, clawing at him to get it back, but he fends me off with ease, with a concrete arm.
"She's a spitfire, Billy boy. I'll bet she's a banshee in bed. I'll bet she knocks over furniture and screams like a porn star, doesn't she?"
A wave of sick rolls over in my stomach as I take in Corbin's words, the unhinged glint in his eyes. I try to scramble backward, but Corbin's hand is an iron vise clamping down on my biceps. There's commotion on the other end of the line, but I can't make out any of Will's words. Whatever his reply, it deepens Corbin's grin. His gaze lands on me, and a leer prowls up his face.
"Don't you worry. I'm sure we'll think of something to do."
Chapter 29. The doorbell rings less than 20 minutes later, and my heart climbs into my throat. How could Will be here already? Where was he hiding? In the garden shed? And why ring the doorbell instead of using his key, or, better yet, busting through the window in a surprise attack? None of it makes any sense. Corbin checks his watch and frowns. From the looks of his expression, he's thinking much the same. There's a smattering of sharp knocks, followed by Evan's muffled voice.
"Hey, Iris, you still up? I think I left my wallet." "Busy night," Corbin quips, but he's talking through gritted teeth.
I lean my head into the adjoining den, spot a patch of shiny leather sticking out from the stack of court record printouts on the coffee table. Evan's wallet. He took it out of his back pocket to sit down, then must have tossed it there and forgotten about it. "Now what?" I say. Corbin watches me for a few seconds, working out what to do, how to fix this problem. He's not worried about Evan. I can tell that much. He's worried about me somehow alerting Evan. I'm the problem.
"Disarm the alarm from your phone. I don't want you anywhere near those panic buttons."
Evan knocks again, this time harder and with his fist.
"Iris, are you in there?"
"Never mind, I'll do it."
Corbin pulls up the alarm app on his phone. His phone, which explains how he got past my alarm, and the pad by the front door gives a trio of staccato beeps. He grabs me by the biceps and pulls me close, his fingers clamping down hard enough to leave a bruise.
Give him his wallet and get rid of him. Do you understand? Otherwise, I'll break his neck and make you watch.
I nod, swallowing. I don't doubt he could do it, too, despite Evan's size.
Good girl.
Corbin turns me around by the shoulders and gives me a hard shove.
Now, go.
There are a number of things I could do here. Slip Evan a sign. Use the distress code when I rearm the system. Bolt out the door and run for my life. But I believed Corbin when he said he would hurt Evan and make me watch, and I couldn't bear either. Besides, leaving or alerting the police means I won't get to see Will again. Which is why I fetch the wallet, plaster on a smile, and head down the hallway, tossing as casual a wave as I can manage to Evan through the glass. He looks relieved to see me, though his shoulders stay up by his ears, like giant humps swallowing his neck until I pull open the door.
Where were you?
Evan says.
I tried to call.
Sorry. Out of the corner of my eye, I catch a flash of movement in the front parlor, Corbin slipping into the shadows. I had my ringer turned off.
Oh.
He lifts a foot as if to take a step inside, but I don't move out of the doorway. I stand there stiffly, holding the door and blocking the entry with my body. There's a long pause. I push his wallet into the space between us. Here, I found it on the table. He takes the wallet with a curious look, then leans far left and peers through the front room window. My heart stops. Other than the beige sofa, the room is practically empty. If Corbin is still standing there, pressed against the opposite side of the wall, Evan will surely see him. But then, Evan straightens, blinking down at me like the only thing he saw was an empty room.
I talked to Zeke. The 678 number is a dead end, unfortunately. A prepay with no name or address attached. There's no way to trace it.
I scrunch up my face, feigning disappointment. Oh, okay. Well, thank him for trying. Good night. I push against the door, but Evan stops it with a palm.
What's up with you?
I make sure to hold his gaze as I shake my head.
Just beat. I was getting ready to head upstairs to bed.
He cocks his head, frowning slightly.
You look like you've been crying.
It's been a rough day.
Oh, well, if you want to talk.
He lets the rest trail while his gaze fishes over my shoulder, craning his head into the house as much as I'll let him, which is not far. Besides my staircase and the lit-up hallway behind me, he probably can't see much.
All right, well, I don't want to keep you. Thanks for this.
He holds up his wallet, wagging it as he mouths two words.
You okay?
I push up a reassuring smile. You're welcome. Call you tomorrow. And then I shut the door in his face, flip the deadbolts, and head back down the hall. I'm shaking all over by the time I step into the kitchen. Corbin slides from the shadows, holding up a finger. We listen for the sound of Evan's car door banging shut, his motor starting up, and the growl of his engine as he drives away.
Now what?
Corbin's grin is Cheshire wide.
Now we wait.
The clock on the cable box says it's nearing 11. More than an hour since I pushed Evan's wallet through a crack in the front door. Which means I must have been convincing. The police, if he'd alerted them, would have been and gone by now. But the police didn't come, and we're still waiting for Will.
Max, tell me,
Corbin says, stopping his incessant pacing to turn to me, slumped on the den sofa.
Bet you don't know that name, do you?
I shake my head. I've been awake for what feels like weeks, and now that the adrenaline has burned off, I can barely sit up straight. Corbin hits the end of the carpet and whirls around, punching a fist into the air.
What about Dennis Siama or Andrea Del Verrocchio? No?
No. I stifle a yawn.
Mentors to Albert Einstein, Stephen Hawking, Leonardo da Vinci, respectively.
Oh, it doesn't help that Corbin has been talking nonstop. Long, rambling verbiage that goes round and round and nowhere at all, except maybe Crazy Town. I stopped listening ages ago.
Why is Will getting all the credit? What is wrong with our society that we only acknowledge the quarterback and not the rest of the team, the lead singers and not the band, when in reality, we're the brilliant ones here. Without us to lift them up, they'd have never made it out of obscurity.
Corbin's narcissistic personality disorder is textbook. A grandiose sense of self, a preoccupation with power and success, an outrageous sense of entitlement, and a distinct lack of empathy. The symptoms are all there. In his manic state, he's no longer bothering to disguise any of them.
Kind of like Netta Snook, I say.
What a narcissist wants more than anything else is the accolades he feels he deserves.
Who?
The female pilot who taught Amelia Earhart to fly.
Exactly.
He stabs a finger at my face.
You understand what I'm talking about.
What I understand is that this isn't just about Will taking the money. It's about Will taking the money and running away. Corbin feels abandoned. He feels rejected and cast aside. And it's this emotion that has triggered his rage. He resumes his pacing, launching into yet another tirade about how no one seems to appreciate his brilliance. How it was his idea to transfer stock, and not the more easily traceable money, to a company in the Bahamas. He's the one who knew when to sell the stock for top market price. If it weren't for him, Will would still be selling dime bags on the street corner. Narcissists love to play the victim. He stops, looking down at me with a frown.
I'm beginning to think your husband is going to stand us up.
He wouldn't. I say it with much more confidence than I feel. Will's already proved he loves money more than me. Why not let Corbin make good on his threats to rape me? Why not let him get his revenge? Except, he said he was coming. He told me he was on his way.
I'm so sorry,
Will says in my head, as clearly as if he were sitting right here, on the couch next to me. For a second or two, I see him driving down a dusty Mexican road, one hand flicking in a wave out the open window. No, Corbin was right about one thing. Will would hate it in Mexico. Too damn hot. Corbin's gaze whips to the back door.
Did you hear that?
I push myself up on the couch, ears straining. Hear what?
Shh!
He cocks his head, then sticks a finger into the air.
That. Did you hear it?
I think I might have heard something. A crunching outside the window, maybe. Or the snap of a twig. Right before a neighbor's dog goes ballistic. His barks spark another, then another, carrying across the neighborhood until the barking comes at me in surround sound. It's like that cartoon scene, when the dogs are alerting each other to a couple of missing Dalmatians. Only this time, they're alerting Corbin to someone right outside my window. I flip around on the couch and cut my hands to the glass, trying to see out, but it's like looking into a black hole, dark and endless. Somewhere in the near distance, the dogs go nuts. The house line rings. Corbin frowns, and I can tell he's thinking the same thing I am. Why wouldn't Will call on my cell like he did last time? The phone rings again.
Should I? Don't move,
he barks. He fetches the handheld off the stand in the kitchen and looks at the display.
It's a 770 number.
He reads the rest of the digits out loud.
Do you recognize it?
I shake my head. I don't think so. My phone flips the call to voicemail, and the caller hangs up. If there's someone still under the window, I can't hear it over the dogs and the thundering of my heart. 2 seconds later, the phone starts up again. This time, Corbin hits the button to pick up on the first ring.
Hello?
Not a question, but a demand. Corbin's expression changes as distinctly as storm clouds scudding across the sun, turning light to dark. Whoever is on the other line is a surprise, and not a pleasant one.
You've got it all wrong, friend. I'm here as a guest. Iris is...
The caller cuts him off, and the fact that Corbin lets him tells me it's someone Corbin is trying to appease. Narcissists are masters at manipulation, and though his silence says he's listening, his movements are preoccupied. His eyes scan the windows, and his body draws in on itself, like a rattlesnake coiling to spring.
I'd love to do that,
Corbin says, his tone steering toward cajoling.
But her Ambien just kicked in. I don't know if you've heard, but she recently lost her husband, and she's not handling it very well.
Next door, a light flips on, illuminating at least three silhouettes just outside. I blink, and the bodies slide into the shadows. Corbin's voice, when he speaks again, is cold as frozen concrete.
I see.
See what? I don't see a thing. Is it Will outside my window? Where is he? I scan the windows, study Corbin's expression, but I don't understand anything. Corbin holds out the receiver, knocks it against my skull.
Tell the cops you're fine, that this is all one big misunderstanding. Tell them I'm here as your guest, and to get the fuck off your property.
When I can't choke out an answer, he makes a disgusted sound.
Never mind, I'll do it myself. Get the fuck off her property, assholes!
He chucks the receiver onto the floor and sighs.
It seems we have a little problem.
Under any other set of circumstances, Corbin's understatement might be amusing, but now his answer sucks some of the steam from my confusion. As far as I can tell, the house is surrounded by police, and Corbin is looking at me like he doesn't know what to do with me, which is not good. From where I'm sitting, there's only one way out. A cornered man has nothing to lose. Whoever's on the other side of that glass needs to shoot, and do it now. But would the police do that? Would they shoot an unarmed man? As if Corbin is thinking the exact same thing, he lifts both hands into the air and does a slow 360 before the window.
Move along, folks,
his smile seems to say.
Nothing to see here.
I notice every detail of what happens next in crisp, sharp focus. How the bullet hits the window with a hard pop, busting a neat hole in the center of the plate glass. How it whizzes past me with a breathy hiss, a spark of silver and air. How, when it hits Corbin, his head jerks back, and his blood and brain splatter like a Jackson Pollock painting on me and the wall. How the floorboards quake when his body hits the ground, a 200-plus-pound solid mass of concrete bone and muscle. And then the back door explodes open, a burst of wood and glass and boot, and an army of uniformed police swarm through. Their guns are drawn, and they're aimed, every single one, at Corbin. One of them drops to his knees and feels for a pulse, which may be standard procedure, but in this case, completely unnecessary. Corbin's eyes are open, but he's missing a big chunk of his forehead. A female officer crouches next to me. Ma'am, are you okay? She runs her hands along my face and neck, her fingers probing into my shaking skin. When she pulls away, her hands are streaked with blood. It's not mine, I say, but my teeth are chattering, and the words get swallowed up by all the yelling. A big, dark-haired man behind her is doing most of it.
Which one of you assholes fired?
His face is purple, and he's screaming so hard, spittle sprays in a perfect arc from his mouth.
The suspect was unarmed. Who fired, goddammit?
The female officer ignores him, reaching around me for the Afghan on the sofa and draping it around my shaking shoulders. We need to warm you up. You're in shock. She twists around, yells into the room. Can we get an EMT over here? The EMTs trot up with a stretcher, but when they get a load of Corbin leaking onto my floor, they slow down considerably. One of them breaks away, approaching me with a medical bag. He takes my blood pressure and checks my vitals, while snippets of conversations float all around. The police set up a perimeter around the house, then hunkered down to wait. The hostage negotiator called Corbin on the house line. The plan was to talk him down. The order was not to shoot. And yet, Corbin took one bullet to the left temple. No one here is claiming responsibility for firing it. The answer lurches me to my feet, and I spring over the coffee table, hurling myself through the bodies crowding the room. Hands grab at me, and I shake them off, sprinting out the back door. Will! The dogs start up again, and I yell it even louder. Will! I tear across my backyard to the fence, my head whipping back and forth, my gaze searching in the shadows. I'm frantic, wild, and hysterical, desperate to find my husband, who I know, is the one who fired the shot. I cup my hands and scream his name into the sky, even though I know he's not here. By now, Will is long gone. The realization is like a kick to the gut, and I double over, wrapping both arms around my middle and wailing. Fury and frustration sweep over me in waves, gaining strength on the replay of tonight's events. Strong hands clamp onto my shoulders and pull me up and back, turning me into a familiar embrace.
"You're okay,"
Evan says, his big arms wrapping tightly around me.
"I've got you."
Chapter 30.
"Mrs. Griffith?" a female voice says. I look up from where my face is buried in Evan's chest to see that it's Detective Johnson standing at the edge of the grass, the detective we spoke to last week at the station. "We have some questions for you when you're ready." I'm not anywhere near ready. I'm still shaking all over, my muscles tense and slack at the same time, and I feel sick. An adrenaline hangover combined with horror and physical exhaustion. I grab Evan's shirt in both fists and suck a lungful of crisp night air. The backyard spins.
"I think I need to sit down."
Evan's demeanor shifts in an instant, switching from friend and consoler to solemn lawyer mode.
"My client needs a few moments to collect herself."
Detective Johnson locks eyes with me for a span of a couple breaths.
"She's got 10, but have her do it somewhere else. This backyard is an active crime scene, and y'all are contaminating it."
He gazes beyond her to the house, and a dozen or so officers swarming on the other side of the lit-up windows of my den, taking photographs and collecting evidence.
"Let's talk in my car,"
he says, leading me to the side of the house.
"That's fine," Detective Johnson calls out behind us. "But do not leave the premises. 10 minutes, Mr. Sheffield, and then I'm coming down there to get her. Understood?"
"Understood."
At the front of the house, a long line of police cars and ambulances stand silent and empty on the street, their blue and red lights swirling. A couple of cops stand in a huddle by the mailbox, holding back a pack of curious neighbors. They look up in surprise when they see us coming down the drive, and Evan gives them a quick rundown of the agreement. One of the cops squawks into his walkie-talkie, confirming Evan's tale with Detective Johnson, then waves us on.
"Don't say a word until we're in the car,"
Evan mumbles. I press my lips together, letting him pack me into the passenger seat of his Range Rover. Once I'm in, he jogs around the front to his side, climbs in, and slams the door.
"Holy shit, Iris. Why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you give me a sign?"
"Because I was waiting for Will. I talked to him, Evan. He called me on the phone."
"Whose phone?"
Evan doesn't seem all that surprised, but he does look concerned.
"My cell."
As I say the words, the realization hits, and I fumble for the phone in my pocket.
"Will called me, which means I have his number. I can call him back."
I pull up the log and hit redial on the top number. A few seconds later, three melodic beeps come down the line, then a recording in French that is slow and straightforward enough for me to get the gist. The number has been disconnected.
"How can that be? He called me from this number just an hour ago."
I hit end, punch redial, tears of fury and frustration building all over again when I get the same result.
"Damn it!"
I mash the buttons and try again. He wraps a palm over my hands, stilling them.
"It's okay. We'll figure it out," okay? We'll find him.
I nod, the movement fast and frantic, but the relief is instant. So far, Evan has done everything he said he would do, and more.
I release a breath, and my shoulders drop a good 3 inches.
If he says he'll help me find Will, Evan will help me find Will.
Once Evan sees I'm calm, he settles back into his seat.
Okay, tell me everything, starting the second I left.
The words come out as frenzied as I feel, jumbled and in spurts and starts, tumbling one over the next at breakneck speed.
My story is all over the place, but Evan listens without interruption, without even an occasional nod.
The entire time, his gaze never leaves my face.
Will shot Corbin. I'm positive of it. He called the police, and when he saw they weren't going to do it, Will took the shot himself.
Will didn't call the police, Iris. I did.
What?
He swipes a hand down his face, his fingers digging into his beard, and nods.
After you handed me my wallet, I couldn't shake the feeling there was something wrong. The whole way home, I kept thinking I missed something, some signal you were trying to give me that things weren't right. I was drifting when it came to me. Your alarm wasn't on. Not when you answered the door, and not when you closed it. You didn't arm the system.
Because we were waiting for Will.
So you said.
What? You don't believe me?
No, I do. I do believe you. But if you're right, if Will's the one who pulled the trigger, that means he's guilty of a lot more than just embezzlement. Assuming it wasn't one of them, the police are going to treat Corbin's death as a murder. They're going to put manpower behind finding his killer.
My mind is depleted by the night's events, from trying to beat back my surging emotions like an exasperating game of whack-a-mole. So it takes more than a few seconds for Evan's words to register. But when they do, when the magnitude of his meaning hits, it straightens my spine and skids my voice back into hysteria.
But that's not right! Will killed Corbin because otherwise Corbin would have killed me!
Iris, Corbin was unarmed.
So? People can kill with their hands, especially when they're attached to arms as big as Corbin's. And Will knew him. He knew what he was capable of.
Calm down. I'm on your side, remember? And I'm glad as hell somebody shot that asshole before he laid a finger on you. But you need to slow down long enough to think about where the police are coming from, especially once they learn Corbin was here for the money. That gives Will motive. It makes what Will did murder.
Something heavy and unpleasant washes over me, and I realize with a start that it's disappointment. Ridiculous. What was I expecting here? For Will to come home? For him to apologize and beg my forgiveness? For me to somehow find a way to give it to him? For us to pick up and move on as if nothing has happened? Beyond all the lies and betrayals Will carved into our marriage, $5 million is still missing. And now there's a man, a horrible, awful, despicable man, murdered. There's no reset button on this thing.
Evan's gaze fishes over my shoulder and sticks. I twist on my seat to see Detective Johnson standing on my front stoop, watching us.
Her suspicions are already up,
Evan says, his gaze coming back to mine.
Whatever you tell her, she's going to be looking for inconsistencies.
Are you telling me to lie?
Hell no. I'm telling you to think long and hard about what you do say.
I give him a squinty look, thinking it still sounds an awful lot like the same thing.
You don't have much time.
Detective Johnson must have given him a sign, because he nods over my shoulder.
Look, I'll plead emotional exhaustion and shock. See if I can hold the big questions off for a day or two. But you're still going to have to give her a statement tonight. She's going to want the basics before she'll release you.
I sigh, trying to settle my thoughts, but there are too many, and I'm too tired. The exhaustion has made me sluggish, like my brain cells are swimming through sorghum syrup. I lean my head on the headrest and close my eyes just for a second. A warm palm wraps around my wrist.
Iris, did you hear me?
I heard you. I open my eyes and sigh, reaching for the car door. Let's get this over with. When you know what to look for, spotting a lie is pretty easy. You see it in the fidgets and sudden head movements, or sometimes when the person is overcompensating through no movements at all. In how their breathing changes, or how they provide too much information, repeating phrases and offering up irrelevant details. In the way they shuffle their feet, or touch their mouths, or put a hand to their throats. It's basic psychology, physical signs that the body doesn't agree with the words coming out of its mouth. So when Detective Johnson asks me what my relationship was with Corbin Hayes, I meet her gaze with a perfectly calm face. He was a friend of Will's from the gym. The three of us are huddled in my driveway, Evan and I shoulder to shoulder, Detective Johnson scribbling furiously onto a pad. The dogs are finally quiet, but the air is chilly and the street busy. By now, the media has gotten wind of the evening's drama. Their vans line the curb, satellite dishes pointed to the stars. A dozen or so reporters are lined up in front of them, aiming their cameras and microphones up my lawn. Evan shifts his big body in front of mine, doing his best to keep my face off the morning news. Detective Johnson keeps going like they're not even there. What time did he arrive?
Around 10 or so.
I keep my tone even and breathing steady, and I answer only the question that is asked. Nothing more, nothing less.
Why did he stay so long?
Because he had this crazy idea that my husband was still alive. He claimed Will owed him money.
She raises her brows at the crazy.
Last Thursday, when you came to see me with a statement, you agreed. When I asked you if you were positive your husband was on that plane, you said no. You thought he might still be alive, too.
It's been an emotional couple of weeks.
Tell the truth, but misleadingly. That is the key to lying. Detective Johnson scribbles my answer onto her pad, followed by a big question mark. I know her next question before she poses it.
What about now? Do you think your husband is still alive now?
I mold my face into a half-amused frown.
That would make me as crazy as Corbin, wouldn't it?
That's not exactly an answer.
Her response isn't exactly a question either, one I'm not about to touch.
Mrs. Griffith, did your husband own a gun?
Not that I'm aware of.
Did he ever go hunting or to the shooting range?
You're asking if he knew how to use a gun?
Yes.
Again, not that I'm aware of.
That's enough. It's late.
Evan swings an arm around my shoulders. I'll call you in the morning to set up a time for the full interview, as soon as Mrs. Griffith is rested. Detective Johnson doesn't look happy about it, but she relents. Her gaze burns between my shoulder blades as I turn toward Evan's car. The reporters are ready, and they take off like racehorses released from the gate, sprinting across the lawn with their microphones and cameras bobbing. They shout my name and a jumbled slew of questions I can't decipher.
No comment,
Evan barks, holding them off with an arm, and then he packs me into his SUV. 2 seconds later, his engine roars underneath us, and we peel away.
You should rest,
he says as soon as we're around the corner. The radio is on, the volume turned low to some country station, and the car smells like Evan, leather, and spice.
I'll wake you when we get there.
I sink deeper into the seat with a loud yawn.
Where's there?
My house. And before you say a word, I'm not taking you to a hotel, so don't even ask.
I don't ask. I'm too tired to argue anyway. I close my eyes, barely even noticing that I'm drifting off.
Chapter 31.
I awaken in a strange room, and it takes me a second or two to remember where I am. Evan's guest room, with its private bath and lock on the door. He was right. The bed is beyond comfortable. I stretch out over the king-size mattress, wondering how I got here. The last thing I remember was Evan telling me to rest. When my eyes slid shut, we hadn't even made it out of my neighborhood yet. Last night's events play out in freeze frames in my mind. A black body sliding from the shadows of my front room. Will's voice in my ear, telling me to get out. Corbin's lecherous grin. His brain splattered on my den wall, his skull leaking a thick and gooey puddle onto the carpet. So much blood. Without warning, a wave of nausea pitches up my throat. I lurch out of bed and sprint to the toilet, barely making it on time. My last meal was ages ago, and there's little in my stomach, but I throw it all up, over and over, until all that's left is bile. I flush the sick down, but the dizziness doesn't pass.
Will was there. I'm sure of it. He was, what, 20 feet away?
His voice haunts me.
Iris, get out of there. I'm on my way.
Despite Corbin's threats and my terror, the only thing I felt when Will's words traveled down the line was relief. Relief that he was alive, that he was coming for me, that finally, after all the heartache and drama, I would see him again. And now? Now, all I feel is a 10-ton weight of disappointment that I didn't, and a looming sense of dread for what comes next. I brush my teeth with a new toothbrush and mini tube of toothpaste on the bathroom counter, select a t-shirt and pair of yoga leggings from the stack of Susanna's clothes Evan left on the dresser for me, then make my way into the hall. Evan's house is gorgeous. High ceilings, generous moldings, sunny, spacious rooms, decorated in neutral colors, each one prettier than the next. I take my time moving down the hall, swinging my head left and right, admiring Susanna's exquisite taste, until I come to a closed door. The last room on the left, and I know whose it is. If I push the door open, I'm certain the walls inside will be painted pink. By the stairs, I pause at a wall of framed photographs, wedding portraits and vacation snapshots, interspersed with more recent baby pictures. A black-and-white shot of a gorgeous dark-haired woman is in the dead center, a tiny infant on her chest. My heart twists for two people I never knew, but mostly for the man I hear banging around downstairs. How does he walk by this picture every day? Does he cover his eyes? Does he look away? I wouldn't be able to stand it. I pad downstairs, where the scent of something scorched rings another wave of nausea from my empty stomach. I wait until it passes, then follow the noise into a chef's kitchen, dark cabinets, and gleaming stainless appliances. Evan stands behind the island, slicing a red pepper into long, thin strips on a chopping block. "Hey," I say. He glances up, then sucks a breath, quick and sudden, through his nose. It's a reflex, one of those involuntary responses to pain, the lungs version of a flinch. I know, because it happens to me, too, those memories that slam into me when I least expect them. "Sorry," I say, already backing out of the room. "I'll go change."
No, that's okay. I'm fine."
He clears his throat, shakes his head.
"Well, not fine, but I will be. Soon."
This is why I didn't want to come, because I'd be stepping into memories that aren't mine, treading onto territory where I don't belong or feel welcome.
"You sure?"
I pluck at Susanna's t-shirt. "Because I don't mind."
"No, keep 'em on. Yours are filthy. I figured y'all were about the same size."
He waves me in with the blade of his knife, gestures to a seat across the island.
"Come on in. Sit down. I'm just making dinner."
"Dinner?" I look around for a clock. "What time is it?"
"Just past 6. You slept for almost 17 hours.
My eyes go wide, and I sink onto a stool. 17 hours? How is that even possible? I haven't slept that long since... Since junior year, when Scott Smith gave me mono, and I did it without one of my brother's little blue pills. Evan snorts.
If there's one thing I've learned these past 2 weeks, it's that grief is exhausting.
I need to call my boss.
No need. I already talked to Ted. Your mom, too. She's a trip, by the way. She said to call her the second you get a chance. Ted said to take however long you need.
What about the police?
Detective Johnson was a great deal less understanding. She said if you weren't awake by the morning, she was coming over here to see for herself. I assured her that wouldn't be necessary, that we would drop by the station first thing tomorrow to make a statement.
Did she give you any news?
Some. I thought I'd fill you in over dinner. Then we'll hammer out a plan.
He hikes a thumb over his shoulder to the stove, where black steam is rising from a pan like a smokestack.
I'm making enchiladas.
Okay, but, I point, and Evan turns to look. He lunges for the pan, jerking it up off the gas, but it's too late. The contents are already chunks of charred cement. He dumps it, pan and all, into the sink, and turns on the water with a hiss.
New plan. What do you like on your pizza?
I want to come stay with you, Mom says into the phone, and I picture her standing in her foyer with her overnight bag, car keys clutched in a fist. When can I come?
I'm seated at Evan's kitchen table, watching him scrub the pan with steel wool and elbow grease. He doesn't seem to be making any progress. Every time he rinses the soap off to check, he starts in all over again. As soon as I get my house back. Unlike Mom's voice, shrill and verging on hysterical, I'm careful to keep mine even. It's still a crime scene, and I'm still at Evan's. When he hears his name, he gives me a chin lift.
That sweet man, Mom says. Give him a big hug from me, will you? Tell him I can't thank him enough. Tell him right now.
A warm rush of affection pushes a smile up my cheeks, because Mom's right. Evan Sheffield is a gem. He's one of the good guys. Despite the horrendous calamity that collided our two worlds together, I feel like I've somehow won a prize. Mom says she can't thank you enough. Evan looks up from the sink with a grin, then flips off the faucet and chucks the pan in the trash.
Tell her I like pie. Cherry especially.
I do, and Mom promises to bake him one very soon. She sighs, a long release of stress and relief.
I'm just so glad you're okay.
We chat a bit longer, but I don't tell her about talking to Will. I'm not ready. I need to hammer out a plan with Evan first. And until I'm certain about what I'm going to say to Detective Johnson, I don't want to involve anyone else, least of all my mother, in either lies or half-truths. I plead exhaustion and promise a longer call tomorrow, and then we hang up. Evan slides an icy bottle of beer across the table to me and sinks into a chair.
The police found the missing APSEC money.
All of it?
Almost all. Looks like it's short a couple hundred grand.
He pauses to take a swig.
They found the statements on Corbin's computer.
The realization is like the unveiling of a statue, when someone whips off the sheet and all is revealed. My understanding is that instant. I don't wonder for a second how the money got there or why.
Well, he put it there to frame Corbin.
Evan shrugs, but his expression says he doesn't disagree.
Corbin worked at the bank that handled all of APSEC's transactions. He
moved the stock to a company he controlled in the Bahamas, then sold it for top price.
I know.
Corbin told me 1,000 times. But why would Will leave all the money? If he went to all that trouble to steal it, why not leave just enough to implicate Corbin and take the rest?
Maybe it wasn't only about implicating Corbin. Maybe it was also about clearing suspicions. With the money accounted for, the police wouldn't have any reason to look for him.
Except now they suspect him of murder.
Maybe. But as far as I can gather, they have very little to go on beyond a trampled-down patch of grass by your shed and the bullet the coroner dug out of Corbin's skull. Pretty useless until they can find the gun it came from. Which they won't.
I don't know what Will did with it. But I know this for a fact. That gun will never be found. Evan takes a long drag from his bottle and shakes his head.
Before last night, I would have said, no way. No way can somebody execute that kind of crime without making a mistake. Nobody is that smart. But your husband just might be, because while all this is going down here, Liberty Air retrieved his briefcase from the crash site. It was pretty wrecked and filthy, and it's been rained on repeatedly, but his laptop was still in one piece. It's being sent to the lab for analysis, but who knows what, if anything, they'll be able to pull off there.
I do. I know what they'll be able to pull off there. Nothing. Not one speck of evidence that Will was involved in any way in the AppSec heist. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that every single byte they manage to pull from that machine will prove without a shadow of a doubt exactly the opposite. That Will was an ideal employee who wouldn't dream of stealing a dime.
Look, I consider you a friend, which means I appreciate the dilemma you're in. If the police find evidence that Will's still alive, if they can pin Corbin's death on him, Will is going to prison, no doubt about it. I know after everything, seeing that happen would be devastating.
I nod, waiting for the but that's coming at me like a missile.
But, as your attorney, I have to counsel you not to lie. Perjury is a crime, and it's a serious offense. Spousal privilege says you don't have to reveal the contents of the phone call. But if they ask you if you've spoken to Will since the crash, and you say something I know to be false, our confidentiality still applies, but I won't be able to defend you.
I understand, and I wouldn't put you in that position.
You came awfully close last night.
His words are firm, but his tone is gentle.
I won't do it again. Fair enough.
He nods, slapping both his hands on the table, as if the matter's settled.
So, any idea what you're going to say? It'll work in both of our favors if I get a heads up before we walk into there tomorrow morning.
I picture my husband standing in the shadows by the shed, his face hard with fury, aiming a gun at a man through my window. I picture him pulling the trigger without hesitation, sending that bullet flying down its deadly path, and my stomach sours. Yes, he did it for me, to save me, but still, Will murdered a man, shot him dead. And when it comes down to it, all over a pile of money. And then I see my husband down on his knee in that Kroger aisle, his face equal parts nervousness and hope. When he said those four little words I'd been waiting to hear, will you marry me? I remember the joy that sparkled inside, the tears that fell down my smiling cheeks as I told him yes, 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 yes. Can I really come clean? Can I really tell the police my husband is alive? That he's a murderer? I close my eyes. I have no idea. The doorbell rings, heralding the arrival of dinner.
Think about it and let me know, okay?
Evan says, wrapping a palm around mine before he stands.
If I can't be your lawyer, I'll always be your friend.
Chapter 32.
I settle the last from the tray of purple phlox into the soil at my mailbox and pat the dirt all around. It's a glorious Sunday morning, and Atlanta's spring has made a spectacular appearance. Bright sunshine, low humidity, and flowers everywhere, in window boxes, lining the streets, in great pink and white bursts on dogwoods and cherry trees. The blooms blanket the city with a layer of yellow pollen, choking me with allergies as thick as my dread. It's day 33, not that I'm counting, and still no sign of Will. There are more than 12,000 surveillance cameras in this city, and that number keeps growing, Detective Johnson said to me only a few days ago. You can't make it through a day here without being recorded somewhere. Her words were as much as a promise as a warning. According to Liberty Airlines and the Georgia Department of Public Health, William Matthew Griffith is dead. According to Detective Johnson and the Atlanta Police Department, however, the matter isn't so clear. Corbin's killer has not been found. Will's DNA has not been pulled from the wreckage either. But since there's a death certificate, there were a flurry of letters going back and forth between the insurance companies and Evan's firm, and last week he handed me a trio of checks with a long line of zeros. I did as Evan advised and deposited them into an interest-bearing account until we know for sure, which, of course, I already do. But as of today, I'm the only one. Will covered his tracks well. The police couldn't trace any of the phone numbers back to him, not from my cell and not from Corbin's. They couldn't find a single file on the recovered computer to implicate Will in the embezzlement. The only reason they have to suspect he's alive at all is me, because I told Detective Johnson the truth. That morning I made my statement was like a cleanse, flushing out all the toxins. I told her everything, starting the morning of the crash. She didn't seem surprised, but until she finds hard evidence either way, alive or dead, she said it's best not to touch a cent of the money.
"Hey, Iris,"
my neighbor Celeste calls from across the street. She gestures to the flowers I've planted to replace the bushes the police and press flattened.
"Looks pretty."
I brush off my hands and push to a stand. "Thanks. Just trying to spruce things up before the place goes on the market tomorrow." As I say the words, a sharp pain hits me in the center of the chest. Despite the millions gathering dust in a bank account, I'm selling the house. I can't afford the mortgage on my own, and my credit cards are already maxed out, paying for the care of Will's father. I've moved him from that horrid facility to a private memory care center, a beautiful building with sunny rooms and a cheerful staff. The monthly bills are killing me, and though Evan assures me money won't be a problem by the time he's done with Liberty Air, Tiffany's story checked out, and she even produced a few damning photographs of the bachelor party in full swing to back it up. The investigation will take months or even years to sort through. My broker assures me there's no better time to sell than now.
It's springtime in a booming real estate market, Iris. You're going to get top dollar.
And it makes me want to shake her. I'm not selling the house for the profit, you idiot. I'm selling it because I need the cash. I tell myself it's just a house, an inconsequential and inanimate thing, and losing it can't erase the memories I made here. But it still stings. Despite my half-empty bed, despite the blood that was shed here, I don't want to leave. Only a month ago, Will and I were trying to fill this place with babies.
"Oh, no. You're moving?"
Celeste makes a too bad face, and her eyes dart around like goldfish. I can practically hear her thinking, "Whatever will we talk about once you're gone?" I nod. This place is too big for just me. Another pang, just as sharp as the first. That morning of the crash, I wanted so badly to be pregnant, and I was, officially, for almost a week. Turns out I was a statistic, one of the 1 in 10 pregnancies that ends in early miscarriage, and the crying jag lasted almost as long. I tell myself it's better this way, that a baby would have united Will and me inextricably and forever in a bond much more complicated than marriage. But it still hurts to think about what could have been. Celeste gives me a bright smile.
"Well, sure, miss, having you around."
I'll bet. The press seems to have finally lost interest in my story, but my neighbors haven't. They ring my doorbell all day long, popping by with casseroles and lasagnas, peppering me with questions about that night, hoping I'll share a gory detail or two that they haven't already heard on the news. My 15 minutes of fame have made me the most popular resident in all of Inman Park. But just like I do now with Celeste, I smile and thank them politely, and then I move along. Evan calls on my cell as I'm walking into the house.
"Hey."
"Hey," I say, and already I'm smiling. Evan and I talk a handful of times a day, and our conversations always start like this. What's up?
Braves versus the Cards at 2. That's what's up.